the dictator role, whereas a democratic group might sometimes behave more as if it had a will that was a composite or average of the wills of its various constituents. But one can also imagine governance institutions that would make an organization behave in a way that is not a simple function of the wills of its sub-agents. Theoretically, at least, there could exist a totalitarian state that everybody hated, because the state had mechanisms to prevent its citizens from coordinating a revolt. Each citizen could be worse off by revolting alone than by playing their part in the state machinery. By designing appropriate institutions for a composite system, one could thus try to shape its effective motivation. In Chapter 9, we discussed social integration as a possible capability control method, but there, we focused on the incentives faced by an agent as a consequence of its existence in a social world of near equals. Here, we are focusing on what happens inside a given agent, how its will is determined by its internal organization. We are therefore looking at a motivation selection method. Moreover, since this kind of internal institution design does not depend on large-scale social engineering or reform, it is a method that might be available to an individual project developing superintelligence, even if the wider socio-economic or international milieu is less than ideally favorable. Institution design is perhaps most plausible in contexts where it would be combined with augmentation. If we could start with agents that are already suitably motivated, or that have human-like motivations, institutional arrangements could be used as an extra safeguard to increase the chances that the system will stay on course. For example, suppose that we start with some well-motivated human-like agents. Let us say, emulation. We want to boost the cognitive capacities of these agents, but we worry that the enhancements might corrupt their motivations. One way to deal with this challenge would be to set up a system in which individual emulations function as sub-agents. When a new enhancement is introduced, it is first applied to a small subset of the sub-agents. Its effects are then studied by a review panel composed of sub-agents who have not yet had the enhancement applied to them. Only when these peers have satisfied themselves that the enhancement is not corrupting, is it rolled out to the wider sub-agent population. If the enhanced sub-agents are found to be corrupted, they are not given further enhancements and are excluded from key decision-making functions, at least until the system as a whole has advanced to a point where the corrupted sub-agents can be safely reintegrated. Although the corrupted sub-agents might have gained some advantage from the enhancement, the institutional structure in which they are embedded, and the fact that they constitute a small minority of all sub-agents, would hopefully prevent them from seizing power or spreading their corruption to the overall system. Thus, the collective intelligence and capability of the system could be gradually enhanced in a sequence of small steps, where the soundness of each step is verified by sub-agents only slightly less capable than the new sub-agents that are introduced in that step. The amount of safety obtainable by this kind of institution design is limited by the accuracy of the tests that are used to evaluate the enhanced sub-agents. The problem of test construction is complicated by the fact that the test batteries could only be validated within the pre-existing range of cognitive ability, yet must be applied to agents outside this range. One could mitigate this problem by taking small enhancement steps and by letting the test run for a long time. Such caution, however, would raise the cost and slow progress, which, if a race dynamic is occurring, could mean a project employing these safety measures would place itself at a disadvantage. Even with small steps and extensive testing, there would remain some risk of subtle flaws being introduced, leading to a gradual corruption of the goal system, a corruption that might become manifest only when the system reaches superintelligence. This risk could be reduced by letting the testing condition extend for many steps of cognitive enhancement, so that even agents that have been initially certified as sound and that have received several subsequent enhancements would continue to be under review by a panel of unmodified and uncorrupted original peers, and would remain subject to reversion. Ideally, the testing should be ongoing rather than confined to an initial evaluation period. Human-level sub-agents have the ability to strategize and might thus choose to conceal certain goals while their behavior was being monitored. To enable continuous testing, a hierarchy might be created in which sub-agents at a certain level of capability are tasked with monitoring sub-agents at a somewhat higher level of capability. At the bottom of the capability hierarchy, but at the top of the power hierarchy, would sit the relatively dumb and slow principal. This human principal would be like a demented king who reigns over an incompetent court that oversees a mediocre administration which governs a capable people. Alternatively, he might be likened to the evolutionarily ancient reptilian brain, which ensures that the newer and much cleverer neocortex is employed in the service of goals, such as feeding and copulation. One might question whether such an inverse meritocracy could remain stable. If the bulk of the superintelligent subagents were found to be corrupt, and the humans in charge of the whole thing attempted to roll back many of the preceding enhancements, would the institutional structure be strong enough to withstand the opposition that such a move would engender? In the context of historical or contemporary human societies, the answer perhaps is that this would be implausible. Not that the most capable people consistently rise to power, but we are not literally ruled by chimpanzees either. The issue is less clear, however, in a context where society is implemented as software. Imagine a digital hierarchy that has one highly trained police agent for every two proletarians. It also has one special police agent for every two police agents. It also has one special police agent for every two special police agents, and so forth, so that each layer of overseers has at least half the numbers of the layer it oversees. Imagine further that this society is architected in such a way that a supervisor has big advantages over his subordinates. For example, the supervisor is able to monitor and record everything his subordinates say and do, whereas the supervisor himself is hidden behind a one-way glass, so that his subordinates can only hear the orders and instructions that the superior chooses to transmit. Imagine that supervisors have a panel of buttons that they can press at any time to cause a subordinate to be punished or rewarded, paused, deleted, or reverted to an earlier state. These capabilities would greatly boost the powers of a supervising agent beyond what has been possible historically in even the most totalitarian of organizations. Even this does not exhaust the possible instruments of control. Supervisors might also have at their disposal realistic virtual reality simulations that they can use to probe subordinates' reactions to hypothetical scenarios, such as simulated offers to join a conspiracy, or to slack when they think nobody is watching. Supervisors might additionally have the ability to eavesdrop on internal monologues in the subordinates' minds, and to directly manipulate their emotional states. The upshot is a series of massive advantages for the supervisor. Each supervisor would be a subordinate to another, higher-level supervisor, who would monitor his every move and make sure he did not slacken in the execution of his managerial duties. With this kind of arrangement, it might be possible for the structure to be stable, even if each supervisory level is intellectually somewhat weaker than the level it supervises, and the entire structure, which could include many highly superintelligent agents, may be controlled by a small number of humans with root access. The cost of such an internal control structure would be significant, but not necessarily prohibitive. For example, in the model where each level of supervision has half the numbers of the layer below, the extra computational overhead is bounded at a mere 100% of what the proletarian part of the system costs. Thus, if the dumber boss layers require fewer computations per sub-agent, oversight could be tightened by increasing the ratio, or cost lowered by decreasing it. The extra computational cost would be a major factor in a competitive market scenario. Compare Chapter 11. But looks affordable in the context of a project that is not facing strong immediate competition. There would also be a cost in terms of the development time needed to create and test these supervisory functionalities. A well-resourced project could reduce this time cost by parallelizing the development of the control structure with the development of the machine intelligence. But the extra task load could be prohibitive for smaller projects and for projects caught in a close technology race. One other type of cost also deserves consideration: the risk of mind crimes being committed in this kind of structure. As described, the institution sounds like a rather horrible North Korean labor camp, yet there are ways of at least mitigating the moral problems with running this kind of institution, even if the sub-agents contained in the institution are emulations with full human moral status. At a minimum, the system could rely on volunteering emulations. Each sub-agent could have the option at any time of withdrawing its participation. Terminated emulations could be stored to memory, with a commitment to restart them under much more ideal conditions once the dangerous phase of the intelligence explosion is over. Meanwhile, sub-agents who chose to participate could be housed in very comfortable virtual environments and allowed ample time for sleep and recreation. These measures would impose a cost, one that should be manageable for a well-resourced project under non-competitive conditions. In a highly competitive situation, the cost may be unaffordable, unless an enterprise could be assured that its competitors would incur the same cost. In the example, we imagine the sub-agents as emulations. One might wonder, does the institution design approach require that the sub-agents be anthropomorphic, or is it equally applicable to systems composed of artificial sub-agents? One's first thought here might be skeptical. One notes that despite our plentiful experience with human-like agents, we still cannot precisely predict the outbreak or outcomes of revolutions. Social science can, at most, describe some statistical tendencies. Since we cannot reliably predict the stability of social structures for ordinary human beings, about which we have much data, it is tempting to infer that we have little hope of precision engineering stable social structures for cognitively enhanced human-like agents, about which we have no data, and that we have still less hope of doing so for advanced artificial agents, which are not even similar to agents that we have data about. Yet the matter is not so cut and dried. Humans and human-like beings are complex, but artificial agents could have relatively simple architectures. Artificial agents could also have simple and explicitly characterized motivations. Furthermore, digital agents in general, whether emulations or artificial intelligences, are copyable, an affordance that may revolutionize management, much like interchangeable parts revolutionized manufacturing. These differences, together with the opportunity to work with agents that are initially powerless, and to create institutional structures that use the various above-mentioned control measures, might combine to make it possible to achieve particular institutional outcomes, such as a system that does not revolt, more reliably than if one were working with human beings under historical conditions. But then again, artificial agents might lack many of the attributes that help us predict the behavior of human-like agents. Artificial agents need not have any of the social emotions that bind human behavior, emotions such as fear, pride, and remorse. Nor need artificial agents develop attachments to friends and family. Nor need they exhibit the unconscious body language that makes it difficult for us humans to conceal our intentions. These deficits might destabilize institutions of artificial agents. Moreover, artificial agents might be capable of making big leaps in cognitive performance as a result of seemingly small changes in their algorithms or architecture. Ruthlessly optimizing artificial agents might be willing to take extreme gambles from which humans would shrink. And superintelligent agents might show a surprising ability to coordinate with little or no communication, e.g., by internally modeling each other's hypothetical responses to various contingencies. These and other differences could make sudden institutional failure more likely, even in the teeth of what seem like Kevlar-clad methods of social control. It is unclear, therefore, how promising the institution design approach is, and whether it has a greater chance of working with anthropomorphic than with artificial agents. It might be thought that creating an institution with appropriate checks and balances could only increase safety, or, at any rate, not reduce safety, so that from a risk mitigation perspective, it would always be best if the method were used. But even this cannot be said with certainty. The approach adds parts and complexity, and thus may also introduce new ways for things to go wrong that do not exist in the case of an agent that does not have intelligent sub-agents as parts. Nevertheless, institution design is worthy of further exploration. Synopsis. Goal system engineering is not yet an established discipline. It is not currently known how to transfer human values to a digital computer. Even given human-level machine intelligence, having investigated a number of approaches, we found that some of them appear to be dead ends, but others appear to hold promise and deserve to be explored further. A summary is provided in Table 12. If we knew how to solve the value-loading problem, we would confront a further problem, the problem of deciding which values to load. What, in other words, would we want a superintelligence to want? This is the more philosophical problem to which we turn next. Chapter 13. Choosing the criteria for choosing. Suppose we could install any arbitrary final value into a seed AI. The decision as to which value to install could then have the most far-reaching consequences. Certain other basic parameter choices concerning the axioms of the AI's decision theory and epistemology could be similarly consequential. But, foolish, ignorant, and narrow-minded that we are, how could we be trusted to make good design decisions? How could we choose without locking in forever the prejudices and preconceptions of the present generation? In this chapter, we explore how indirect normativity can let us offload much of the cognitive work involved in making these decisions onto the superintelligence itself, while still anchoring the outcome in deeper human values. The need for indirect normativity. How can we get a superintelligence to do what we want? What do we want the superintelligence to want? Up to this point, we have focused on the former question. We now turn to the second question. Suppose that we had solved the control problem so that we were able to load any value we chose into the motivation system of a superintelligence, making it pursue that value as its final goal. Which value should we install? The choice is no light matter. If the superintelligence obtains a decisive strategic advantage, the value would determine the disposition of the cosmic endowment. Clearly, it is essential that we not make a mistake in our value selection. But how could we realistically hope to achieve errorlessness in a matter like this? We might be wrong about morality, wrong also about what is good for us, wrong even about what we truly want. Specifying a final goal, it seems, requires making one's way through a thicket of thorny philosophical problems. If we try a direct approach, we are likely to make a hash of things. The risk of mistaken choosing is especially high when the decision context is unfamiliar, and selecting the final goal for a machine superintelligence that will shape all of humanity's future is an extremely unfamiliar decision context, if any is. The dismal odds in a frontal assault are reflected in the pervasive dissensus about the relevant issues in value theory. No ethical theory commands majority support among philosophers, so most philosophers must be wrong. It is also reflected in the marked changes that the distribution of moral belief has undergone over time, many of which we like to think of as progress. In medieval Europe, for instance, it was deemed respectable entertainment to watch a political prisoner being tortured to death. Cat-burning remained popular in 16th century Paris. A mere 150 years ago, slavery still was widely practiced in the American South, with full support of the law and moral custom. When we look back, we see glaring deficiencies, not just in the behavior, but in the moral beliefs of all previous ages. Though we have perhaps since gleaned some moral insight, we could hardly claim to be now basking in the high noon of perfect moral enlightenment. Very likely, we are still laboring under one or more grave moral misconceptions. In such circumstances, to select a final value based on our current convictions, in a way that locks it in forever and precludes any possibility of further ethical progress, would be to risk an existential moral calamity. Even if we could be rationally confident that we have identified the correct ethical theory, which we cannot be, we would still remain at risk of making mistakes in developing important details of this theory. Seemingly simple moral theories can have a lot of hidden complexity. For example, consider the unusually simple, consequentialist theory of hedonism. This theory states roughly that all and only pleasure has value, and all and only pain has disvalue. Even if we placed all our moral chips on this one theory, and the theory turned out to be right, a great many questions would remain open. Should higher pleasures be given priority over lower pleasures, as John Stuart Mill argued? How should the intensity and duration of a pleasure be factored in? Can pains and pleasures cancel each other out? What kinds of brain states are associated with morally relevant pleasures? Would two exact copies of the same brain state correspond to twice the amount of pleasure? Can there be subconscious pleasures? How should we deal with extremely small chances of extremely great pleasures? How should we aggregate over infinite populations? Giving the wrong answer to any one of these questions could be catastrophic. If, by selecting a final value for the superintelligence, we had to place a bet, not just on a general moral theory, but on a long conjunction of specific claims about how that theory is to be interpreted and integrated into an effective decision-making process, then our chances of striking lucky would dwindle to something close to hopeless. Fools might eagerly accept this challenge of solving in one swing all the important problems in moral philosophy, in order to infix their favorite answers into the seed AI. Wiser souls would look hard for some alternative approach, some way to hedge. This takes us to indirect normativity. The obvious reason for building a superintelligence is so that we can offload to it the instrumental reasoning required to find effective ways of realizing a given value. Indirect normativity would enable us also to offload to the superintelligence some of the reasoning needed to select the value that is to be realized. Indirect normativity is a way to answer the challenge presented by the fact that we may not know what we truly want, what is in our interest, or what is morally right or ideal. Instead of making a guess based on our own current understanding, which is probably deeply flawed, we would delegate some of the cognitive work required for value selection to the superintelligence. Since the superintelligence is better at cognitive work than we are, it may see past the errors and confusions that cloud our thinking. One could generalize this idea and emboss it as a heuristic principle. The principle of epistemic deference. A future superintelligence occupies an epistemically superior vantage point. Its beliefs are, probably on most topics, more likely than ours to be true. We should therefore defer to the superintelligence's opinion whenever feasible. Indirect normativity applies this principle to the value selection problem. Lacking confidence in our ability to specify a concrete normative standard, we would instead specify some more abstract condition that any normative standard should satisfy, in the hope that a superintelligence could find a concrete standard that satisfies the abstract condition. we could give a seed AI the final goal of continuously acting according to its best estimate of what this implicitly defined standard would have it do. Some examples will serve to make the idea clearer. First, we will consider coherent extrapolated volition, an indirect normativity proposal outlined by Eliza Yadkowsky. We will then introduce some variations and alternatives to give us a sense of the range of available options. Coherent extrapolated volition. Yadkowsky has proposed that a seed AI be given the final goal of carrying out humanity's coherent extrapolated volition, CEV, which he defines as follows. Our coherent extrapolated volition is our wish if we knew more, thought faster, were more the people we wished we were, had grown up farther together, where the extrapolation converges rather than diverges, where our wishes cohere rather than interfere, extrapolated as we wish that extrapolated, interpreted as we wish that interpreted. When Yadkowsky wrote this, he did not purport to present a blueprint for how to implement this rather poetic prescription. His aim was to give a preliminary sketch of how CEV might be defined, along with some arguments for why an approach along these lines is needed. Many of the ideas behind the CEV proposal have analogues and antecedents in the philosophical literature. For example, in ethics, ideal observer theories seek to analyze normative concepts like good or right in terms of the judgments that a hypothetical ideal observer would make, where an ideal observer is defined as one that is omniscient about non-moral facts, is logically clear-sighted, is impartial in relevant ways, and is free from various kinds of biases, and so on. The CEV approach, however, is not, or need not be construed as, a moral theory. It is not committed to the claim that there is any necessary link between value and the preferences of our coherent, extrapolated volition. CEV can be thought of simply as a useful way to approximate whatever has ultimate value, or it can be considered aside from any connection to ethics. As the main prototype of the indirect normativity approach, it is worth examining in a little more detail. Some explications. Some terms in the above quotation require explication. Thought faster, in Yadkowsky's terminology, means if we were smarter and had thought things through more. Grown up farther together seems to mean if we had done our learning, our cognitive enhancing, and our self-improving under conditions of suitable social interaction with one another. Where the extrapolation converges rather than diverges may be understood as follows. The AI should act on some feature of the result of its extrapolation only insofar as that feature can be predicted by the AI with a fairly high degree of confidence. To the extent that the AI cannot predict what we would wish if we were idealized in the manner indicated, the AI should not act on a wild guess. Instead, it should refrain from acting. However, even though many details of our idealized wishing may be undetermined or unpredictable, there might nevertheless be some broad outlines that the AI can apprehend, and it can then at least act to ensure that the future course of events unfolds within those outlines. For example, if the AI can reliably estimate that our extrapolated volition would wish that we not all be in constant agony, or that the universe not be tiled over with paperclips, then the AI should act to prevent those outcomes. Where our wishes cohere rather than interfere may be read as follows. The AI should act where there is fairly broad agreement between individual humans' extrapolated volitions. A smaller set of strong, clear wishes might sometimes outweigh the weak and muddled wishes of a majority. Also, Yadkowsky thinks that it should require less consensus for the AI to prevent some particular narrowly specified outcome, and more consensus for the AI to act to funnel the future into some particular narrow conception of the good. The initial dynamic for CEV, he writes, should be conservative about saying yes and listen carefully for no. Extrapolated as we wish that extrapolated. Interpreted as we wish that interpreted. The idea behind these last modifiers seems to be that the rules for extrapolation should themselves be sensitive to the extrapolated volition. An individual might have a second-order desire, a desire concerning what to desire, that some of her first-order desires not be given weight when her volition is extrapolated. For example, an alcoholic who has a first-order desire for booze might also have a second-order desire not to have that first-order desire. Similarly, we might have desires over how various other parts of the extrapolation process should unfold, and these should be taken into account by the extrapolation process. It might be objected that even if the concept of humanity's coherent extrapolated volition could be properly defined, it would anyway be impossible, even for a superintelligence, to find out what humanity would actually want under the hypothetical idealized circumstances stipulated in the CEV approach. Without some information about the content of our extrapolated volition, the AI would be bereft of any substantial standard to guide its behavior. However, although it would be difficult to know with precision what humanity's CEV would wish, it is possible to make informed guesses. This is possible even today, without superintelligence. For example, it is more plausible that our CEV would wish for there to be people in the future who live rich and happy lives, than that it would wish that we should all sit on stools in a dark room, experiencing pain. If we can make at least some such judgment sensibly, so can a superintelligence. From the outset, the superintelligence's conduct could thus be guided by its estimates of the content of our CEV. It would have strong instrumental reason to refine these initial estimates, e.g., by studying human culture and psychology, scanning human brains, and reasoning about how we might behave if we knew more, thought more clearly, etc. In investigating these matters, the AI would be guided by its initial estimates of our CEV, so that, for instance, the AI would not necessarily run myriad simulations replete with unredeemed human suffering if it estimated that our CEV would probably condemn such simulations as mind crime. Another objection is that there are so many different ways of life and moral codes in the world that it might not be possible to blend them into one CEV. Even if one could blend them, the result might not be particularly appetizing. One would be unlikely to get a delicious meal by mixing together all the best flavors from everyone's different favorite dish. In answer to this, one could point out that the CEV approach does not require that all ways of life, moral codes, or personal values be blended together into one stew. The CEV dynamic is supposed to act only when our wishes cohere. On issues on which there is widespread irreconcilable disagreement, even after the various idealizing conditions have been imposed, the dynamic should refrain from determining the outcome. To continue the cooking analogy, it might be that individuals or cultures will have different favorite dishes, but that they can nevertheless broadly agree that aliments should be non-toxic. The CEV dynamic could then act to prevent food poisoning while otherwise allowing humans to work out their culinary practices without its guidance or interference. Rationales for CEV. Yadkowsky's article offered 7 arguments for the CEV approach. 3 of these were basically different ways of making the point that while the aim should be to do something that is humane and helpful, it would be very difficult to lay down an explicit set of rules that does not have unintended interpretations and undesirable consequences. The CEV approach is meant to be robust and self-correcting. It is meant to capture the source of our values, instead of relying on us correctly enumerating and articulating, once and for all, each of our essential values. The remaining 4 arguments go beyond that first basic, but important point. Spelling out desiderata on candidate solutions to the value specification problem and suggesting that CEV meets these desiderata. Encapsulate moral growth. This is the desideratum that the solution should allow for the possibility of moral progress. As suggested earlier, there are reasons to believe that our current moral beliefs are flawed in many ways, perhaps deeply flawed. If we were to stipulate a specific and unalterable moral code for the AI to follow, we would in effect be locking in our present moral convictions, including their errors, destroying any hope of moral growth. The CEV approach, by contrast, allows for the possibility of such growth because it has the AI try to do that which we would have wished it to do if we had developed further under favorable conditions. And it is possible that if we had thus developed, our moral beliefs and sensibilities would have been purged of their current defects and limitations. Avoid hijacking the destiny of humankind. Yadkowsky has in mind a scenario in which a small group of programmers creates a seed AI that then grows into a superintelligence that obtains a decisive strategic advantage. In this scenario, the original programmers hold in their hands the entirety of humanity's cosmic endowment. Obviously, this is a hideous responsibility for any mortal to shoulder. Yet it is not possible for the programmers to completely shirk the onus once they find themselves in this situation. Any choice they make, including abandoning the project, would have world historical consequences. Yadkowsky sees CEV as a way for the programmers to avoid arrogating to themselves the privilege or burden of determining humanity's future. By setting up a dynamic that implements humanity's coherent extrapolated volition, as opposed to their own volition, or their own favorite moral theory, they in effect distribute their influence over the future to all of humanity. Avoid creating a motive for modern-day humans to fight over the initial dynamic. Distributing influence over humanity's future is not only morally preferable to the programming team implementing their own favorite vision, it is also a way to reduce the incentive to fight over who gets to create the first superintelligence. In the CEV approach, the programmers, or their sponsors, exert no more influence over the content of the outcome than any other person, though they of course play a starring causal role in determining the structure of the extrapolation and in deciding to implement humanity's CEV instead of some alternative. Avoiding conflict is important, not only because of the immediate harm that conflict tends to cause, but also because it hinders collaboration on the difficult challenge of developing superintelligence safely and beneficially. CEV is meant to be capable of commanding wide support. This is not just because it allocates influence equitably. There is also a deeper ground for the ironic potential of CEV, namely that it enables many different groups to hope that their preferred vision of the future will prevail totally. Imagine a member of the Afghan Taliban debating with a member of the Swedish Humanist Association. The two have very different worldviews, and what is a utopia for one might be a dystopia for the other. Nor might either be thrilled by any compromise position, such as permitting girls to receive an education, but only up to 9th grade, or permitting Swedish girls to be educated, but Afghan girls not. However, both the Taliban and the humanist might be able to endorse the principle that the future should be determined by humanity's CEV. The Taliban could reason that if his religious views are in fact correct, as he is convinced they are, and if good grounds for accepting these views exist, as he is also convinced, then humankind would in the end come to accept these views if only people were less prejudiced and biased, if they spent more time studying scripture, if they could more clearly understand how the world works and recognize essential priorities, if they could be freed from irrational rebelliousness and cowardice, and so forth. The humanist, similarly, would believe that under these idealized conditions, humankind would come to embrace the principles she espouses. Keep humankind ultimately in charge of its own destiny. We might not want an outcome in which a paternalistic superintelligence watches over us constantly, micromanaging our affairs with an eye towards optimizing every detail in accordance with a grand plan. Even if we stipulate that the superintelligence would be perfectly benevolent and free from presumptuousness, arrogance, overbearingness, narrow-mindedness, and other human shortcomings, one might still resent the loss of autonomy entailed by such an arrangement. We might prefer to create our destiny as we go along, even if it means that we sometimes fumble. Perhaps we want the superintelligence to serve as a safety net, to support us when things go catastrophically wrong, but otherwise to leave us to fend for ourselves. CEV allows for this possibility. CEV is meant to be an initial dynamic, a process that runs once and then replaces itself with whatever the extrapolated volition wishes. If humanity's extrapolated volition wishes that we live under the supervision of a paternalistic AI, then the CEV dynamic would create such an AI and hand it the reins. If humanity's extrapolated volition instead wishes that a democratic human world government be created, then the CEV dynamic might facilitate the establishment of such an institution and otherwise remain invisible. If humanity's extrapolated volition is instead that each person should get an endowment of resources that she can use as she pleases so long as she respects the equal rights of others, then the CEV dynamic could make this come true by operating in the background much like a law of nature to prevent trespass, theft, assault, and other non-consensual impingements. The structure of this CEV approach thus allows for a virtually unlimited range of outcomes. It is also conceivable that humanity's extrapolated volition would wish that the CEV does nothing at all. In that case, the AI implementing CEV should, upon having established with sufficient probability that this is what humanity's extrapolated volition would wish it to do, safely shut itself down. Further remarks. The CEV proposal, as outlined above, is of course the merest schematic. It has a number of free parameters that could be specified in various ways, yielding different versions of the proposal. One parameter is the extrapolation base. Whose volitions are to be included? We might say everybody, but this answer spawns a host of further questions. Does the extrapolation base include so-called marginal persons, such as embryos, fetuses, brain-dead persons, patients with severe dementias, or who are in permanent vegetative states? Does each of the hemispheres of a split-brain patient get its own weight in the extrapolation, and is this weight the same as that of the entire brain of a normal subject? What about people who lived in the past but are now dead? People who will be born in the future? Higher animals and other sentient creatures? Digital minds? Extraterrestrials? One option would be to include only the population of adult human beings on Earth who are alive at the start of the time of the AI's creation. An initial extrapolation from this base could then decide whether and how the base should be expanded. Since the number of marginals at the periphery of this base is relatively small, the result of the extrapolation may not depend much on exactly where the boundary is drawn, on whether, for instance, it includes fetuses or not. That somebody is excluded from the original extrapolation base does not imply that their wishes and well-being are disregarded. If the coherent, extrapolated volition of those in the extrapolation base, e.g., living adult human beings, wishes that moral consideration be extended to other beings, then the outcome of the CEV dynamic would reflect that preference. Nevertheless, it is possible that the interests of those who are included in the original extrapolation base would be accommodated to a greater degree than the interests of outsiders. In particular, if the dynamic acts only where there is broad agreement between individual extrapolated volitions, as in Yadkowsky's original proposal, there would seem to be a significant risk of an ungenerous blocking vote that could prevent, for instance, the welfare of non-human animals or digital minds from being protected. The result might potentially be morally rotten. One motivation for the CEV proposal was to avoid creating a motive for humans to fight over the creation of the first superintelligent AI. Although the CEV proposal scores better on this desideratum than many alternatives, it does not entirely eliminate motives for conflict. A selfish individual, group, or nation might seek to enlarge its slice of the future by keeping others out of the extrapolation base. A power grab of this sort might be rationalized in various ways. It might be argued, for instance, that the sponsor who funds the development of the AI deserves to own the outcome. This moral claim is probably false. It could be objected, for example, that the project that launches the first successful seed AI imposes a vast risk externality on the rest of humanity, which therefore is entitled to compensation. The amount of compensation owed is so great that it can only take the form of giving everybody a stake in the upside if things turn out well. Another argument that might be used to rationalize a power grab is that large segments of humanity have base or evil preferences, and that including them in the extrapolation base would risk turning humanity's future into a dystopia. It is difficult to know the share of good and bad in the average person's heart. It is also difficult to know how much this balance varies between different groups, social strata, cultures, or nations. Whether one is optimistic or pessimistic about human nature, one may prefer not to wager humanity's cosmic endowment on the speculation that, for a sufficient majority of the 7 billion people currently alive, their better angels would prevail in their extrapolated volitions. Of course, omitting a certain set of people from the extrapolation base does not guarantee that light would triumph, and it might well be that the souls that would soonest exclude others or grab power for themselves tend rather to contain unusually large amounts of darkness. Yet another reason for fighting over the initial dynamic is that one might believe that somebody else's AI will not work as advertised, even if the AI is billed as a way to implement humanity's CEV. If different groups have different beliefs about which implementation is most likely to succeed, they might fight to prevent the others from launching. It would be better, in such situations, if the competing projects could settle their epistemic differences by some method that more reliably ascertains who is right than the method of armed conflict. Morality models. The CEV proposal is not the only possible form of indirect normativity. For example, instead of implementing humanity's coherent extrapolated volition, one could try to build an AI with the goal of doing what is morally right, relying on the AI's superior cognitive capacities to figure out just which actions fit that description. We can call this proposal moral rightness, MR. The idea is that we humans have an imperfect understanding of what is right and wrong, and perhaps an even poorer understanding of how the concept of moral rightness is to be philosophically analyzed. But a superintelligence would understand these things better. What if we are not sure whether moral realism is true? We could still attempt the MR proposal. We should just have to make sure to specify what the AI should do in the eventuality that its presupposition of moral realism is false. For example, we could stipulate that if the AI estimates with a sufficient probability that there are no suitable non-relative truths about moral rightness, then it should revert to implementing coherent, extrapolated volition instead, or simply shut itself down. MR appears to have several advantages over CEV. MR would do away with various free parameters in CEV, such as the degree of coherence among extrapolated volitions that is required for the AI to act on the result, the ease with which a majority can overrule dissenting minorities, and the nature of the social environment within which our extrapolated cells are to be supposed to have grown up farther together. It would seem to eliminate the possibility of a moral failure resulting from the use of an extrapolation base that is too narrow or too wide. Furthermore, MR would orient the AI toward morally right action, even if our coherent extrapolated volitions happen to wish for the AI to take actions that are morally odious. As noted earlier, this seems a live possibility with the CEV proposal. Moral goodness might be more like a precious metal than an abundant element in human nature. And even after the ore has been processed and refined in accordance with the prescriptions of the CEV proposal, who knows whether the principal outcome will be shining virtue, indifferent slag, or toxic sludge. MR would also appear to have some disadvantages. It relies on the notion of morally right, a notoriously difficult concept, one with which philosophers have grappled since antiquity, without yet attaining consensus as to its analysis. Picking an erroneous explication of moral rightness could result in outcomes that would be morally very wrong. This difficulty of defining moral rightness might seem to count heavily against the MR proposal. However, it is not clear that the MR proposal is really at a material disadvantage in this regard. The CEV proposal, too, uses terms and concepts that are difficult to explicate, such as knowledge, being more the people we wished we were, grown up farther together, among others. Even if these concepts are marginally less opaque than moral rightness, they are still miles removed from anything that programmers can currently express in code. The path to endowing an AI with any of these concepts might involve giving it general linguistic ability, comparable at least to that of a normal human adult. Such a general ability to understand natural language could then be used to understand what is meant by morally right. If the AI could grasp the meaning, it could search for actions that fit. As the AI develops superintelligence, it could then make progress on two fronts, on the philosophical problem of understanding what moral rightness is, and on the practical problem of applying this understanding to evaluate particular actions. While this would not be easy, it is not clear that it would be any more difficult than extrapolating humanity's coherent, extrapolated volition. A more fundamental issue with MR is that even if it can be implemented, it might not give us what we want or what we would choose if we were brighter and better informed. This is, of course, the essential feature of MR, not an accidental bug. However, it might be a feature that would be extremely harmful to us. One might try to preserve the basic idea of the MR model while reducing its demandingness by focusing on moral permissibility. The idea being that we could let the AI pursue humanity's CEV so long as it did not act in ways that are morally impermissible. For example, one might formulate the following goal for the AI. Among the actions that are morally permissible for the AI, take one that humanity's CEV would prefer. However, if some part of this instruction has no well-specified meaning, or if we are radically confused about its meaning, or if moral realism is false, or if we acted morally impermissibly in creating an AI with this goal, then undergo a controlled shutdown. Follow the intended meaning of this instruction. One might still worry that this moral permissibility model, MP, represents an unpalatably high degree of respect for the requirements of morality. How big a sacrifice it would entail depends on which ethical theory is true. If ethics is satisficing, in the sense that it counts as morally permissible any action that conforms to a few basic moral constraints, then MP may leave ample room for our coherent, extrapolated volition to influence the AI's actions. However, if ethics is maximizing, for example, if the only morally permissible actions are those that have the morally best consequences, then MP may leave little or no room for our own preferences to shape the outcome. To illustrate this concern, let us return for a moment to the example of hedonistic consequentialism. Suppose that this ethical theory is true, and that the AI knows it to be so. For present purposes, we can define hedonistic consequentialism as the claim that an action is morally right and morally permissible if, and only if, among all feasible actions, no other action would produce a greater balance of pleasure over suffering. The AI, following MP, might maximize the surfeit of pleasure by converting the accessible universe into hedonium, a process that may involve building computronium and using it to perform computations that instantiate pleasurable experiences. Since simulating any existing human brain is not the most efficient way of producing pleasure, a likely consequence is that we all die. By enacting either the MR or the MP proposal, we would thus risk sacrificing our lives for a greater good. This would be a bigger sacrifice than one might think, because what we stand to lose is not merely the chance to live out a normal human life, but the opportunity to enjoy the far longer and richer lives that a friendly superintelligence could bestow. The sacrifice looks even less appealing when we reflect that the superintelligence could realize a nearly as great good, in fractional terms, while sacrificing much less of our own potential well-being. Suppose that we agreed to allow almost the entire accessible universe to be converted into hedonium, everything except a small preserve, say the Milky Way, which would be set aside to accommodate our own needs. Then there would still be 100 billion galaxies devoted to the maximization of pleasure. But we would have one galaxy within which to create wonderful civilizations that could last for billions of years, and in which humans and non-human animals could survive and thrive, and have the opportunity to develop into beatific, post-human spirits. If one prefers this latter option, as I would be inclined to do, it implies that one does not have an unconditional, lexically dominant preference for acting morally permissibly, but it is consistent with placing great weight on morality. Even from a purely moral point of view, it might be better to advocate some proposal that is less morally ambitious than MR or MP. If the morally best has no chance of being implemented, perhaps because of its frowning demandingness, it might be morally better to promote some other proposal, one that would be near ideal and whose chances of being implemented could be significantly increased by our promoting it. Do what I mean. We might feel unsure whether to go for CEV, MR, MP, or something else. Could we punt on this higher level decision as well, offloading even more cognitive work onto the AI? Where is the limit to our possible laziness? Consider, for example, the following reasons-based goal. Do whatever we would have had most reason to ask the AI to do. This goal might boil down to extrapolated volition, or morality, or something else, but it would seem to spare us the effort and risk involved in trying to figure out for ourselves which of these more specific objectives we would have most reason to select. Some of the problems with the morality-based goals, however, also apply here. First, we might fear that this reasons-based goal would leave too little room for our own desires. Some philosophers maintain that a person always has most reason to do what it would be morally best for her to do. If those philosophers are right, then the reason-based goal collapses into MR, with the concomitant risk that a superintelligence implementing such a dynamic would kill everyone within reach. Second, as with all proposals couched in technical language, there is a possibility that we might have misunderstood the meaning of our own assertions. We saw that, in the case of the morality-based goals, asking the AI to do what is right may lead to unforeseen and unwanted consequences, such that, had we anticipated them, we would not have implemented the goal in question. The same applies to asking the AI to do what we have most reason to do. What if we try to avoid these difficulties by couching a goal in emphatically non-technical language, such as in terms of niceness?